On the flat sands of a Florida beach in 1906, a former bicycle mechanic turned auto plant foreman drove a car built out of a canoe powered by a steam engine to a speed of 127.66 miles per hour. He became the first man to travel more than 2 miles per minute in an automobile, instantly became famous around the world, and the unique car he was piloting, the culmination of a life's work of two brilliant twin brothers, would try to kill him just 1 year later. This is the story of the fastest car in the world, the 1906 Stanley Steamer Rocket. So before we jump right into the big moment of triumph on the sands of Ormond Beach, Florida, we have a bunch of stuff to get acquainted with in this story. Stuff like, who are the Stanley brothers? What's a steam car? How does one work? Why they were racing in Florida? And how the heck this thing shocked the world, held an automotive land speed record for 4 years, and the steam speed record for 103 years. Yes, I said 103 years. Oh yeah, and how they made the thing so fast. One more thing to add before we get truly going here. I want to call attention to some of the primary reference materials I used in assembling this story. There's the book The Modern Steam Car and Its Background by Thomas S. Durr, The Steam-Powered Automobile and Answer to Pollution by Andrew Jameson, and a seminal work on this topic entitled Bravo Stanley by H. James Merrick, as well as dozens of vintage newspaper clippings and stories from the likes of the Boston Globe, New York Times, and so many others of the period. Okay, now we have all that out of the way, it's time to get going. So the two guys at the root of our story are Francis Edger, or F.E. Stanley, and his twin brother Freeland Oscar, or F.O. Stanley. Born in 1849 in the small burg of Kingsfield, Maine, they came from a really interesting family. Their father taught, farmed, and stood up to the occasional angry mob. They had a mom that was very well read, and the boys were gifted from birth with creativity and skills well beyond the norm. They had skills in the arts. They made things like violins as a hobby. They were inveterate businessmen and entrepreneurs since they were kids, and even back then they did side jobs to raise money for advanced books and subjects like math, and they used this knowledge they gained as children to their advantage. Between the two of them, there was brilliance in art, education, and a variety of other fields, mechanical and otherwise. There was also the ability to find a way to take their collective talents and make money with them. For instance, a passion and skill for the burgeoning art and process of photography in the 1800s led the brothers to not only start a successful photographic business, but to get in the business of making the plates used in cameras in the 1800s. In fact, they created a machine and a process by which they could make them at a speed 10 times faster than known at that time of existence. This set the brothers on a path of a very comfortable life, and the company, along with its patented machines, would eventually be sold to the massive Eastman Kodak Company, who'd use them both on a grand scale. The Stanley brothers had more than 40 patents to their name over the course of their respective lives, and they covered all manner of machines, automotive technology, methods of building cars, and the list goes on and on. After weathering some issues with their business in the early 1890s, the brothers had their company rocking again, and had gotten into different things like trotting horses and other activities. In 1896, they ventured to the south of Boston to visit an event called the Brockton Fair. Their main interest in attending the fair was to see horse racing, but a sideshow appeared and got their attention. A guy showed up with an early DeDion automobile and was set to make some exhibition laps around the horse track for people in the packed stands. Now, this was a big attraction because cars were such a novelty back then. Unfortunately, this thing didn't complete a single lap before breaking down and being dragged off, presumably, by horses. Now, Effie and F.O. Stanley talked about the broken horseless carriage the whole train ride home, and by the end of it, Effie declared that they'd be making one of their own, which would be better. Not only that, it would perform more than just a single lap, but many laps without issues in front of a crowd. Now, in all my research, there's no one real direct factor as to why the brothers chose steam over the admittedly crude internal combustion engines of the day. Perhaps they understood its principles better, or they found it to be more pleasurable and more palatable than the gasoline engines of the time, but I really don't have a solid answer as to why they pursued steam over internal combustion. Nonetheless, they began an obsession with steam, and that obsession saw them closely inspecting some of the early steam carriages of the era to get ideas. Now, their initial plan called for a steam carriage with a total weight of 500 pounds in full construction. They contracted with a known boiler maker in the area and a motor-making firm in New England, and they received an engine that weighed 400 pounds and a boiler that weighed 200 pounds. Yeah, they were actually 200 pounds in materials overweight before including a single nut or bolt of the actual vehicle. Whoopsie doodle.
Hey everybody, it's Brian Loans. I'd like to start by thanking Upside for sponsoring today's video. Upside is an incredibly cool app you can add to your phone in no time at all that helps you earn money back on purchases that you're already making. Whether it's buying gas, groceries, even going out to eat, or grabbing that food on the go, you're going to earn money back with no hidden points, no fees, no complications. It's super easy. You're going to open the app up, you're going to find the offers in your local area, select one of the offers and take advantage of it. I'll even show you how to use the app right now. It is so easy, I just use it at the gas station today.
Simply pop the app open and select the offer you want to take advantage of. For me, it was a tank of gas. I selected the offer, locked it in, and headed to the station. Once I made my purchase and uploaded my receipt, super easy, Upside took care of the rest. They processed my purchase and added my earnings to my account. Now, the best part is you can choose where the money goes when you decide to cash out. Could be your bank account, could be any number of amazing gift card options to save for a special night out or simply your favorite spot. Upside users are making as much as $280 a year. To find out how much you could earn, click the link in the description to download Upside and use code BrianLoans to get an additional 25 cents back for every gallon of your first tank of gas. Or select the QR code here to claim this offer. Upside is legit. 100,000 locations nationwide. Use it. One thing to consider, this was not some prototype for them to test or sell. This was literally a fun project for the brothers. Building your own car from scratch in 1903 was kind of a rich guy flex. Understanding this, you'll be happy to know that they fired the boiler and cracked the throttle for their first drive in this too-heavy car in September of 1897. After scaring some horses, and likely themselves, they were highly entertained and their path forward was set. They had this idea and many ideas that they wanted to improve upon, and they wanted to build more cars for themselves. These would be family transportation and tinker toys. The first thing the brothers did was to design their own light and very strong boilers. These would handle a maximum of 600 psi of pressure and weigh 90 pounds, and they were rock solid and safe. Friends and steam engine masters J.W. Penny and Son from Mechanics Falls, Maine, were hired to build engines for their three cars. Now, they understood the assignment better than the other company because the guys at J.W. Penny provided a two-cylinder engine that came back at 35 pounds in total weight. The brothers had planned to build three more cars along with their first two-heavy automobile. There would be a four-passenger Surrey and two two-passenger automobiles or horseless carriages. And again, the intention here was to simply build this stuff for themselves and after they had done that, move on with their lives to the next hobby. As it turns out, they disliked the four-passenger Surrey so much they dismantled it soon after completion. And despite the plan to keep the cars for themselves, F.O. Stanley was so roundly pestered by a rich guy that he sold his car to him just to get the guy off his back. Next, we come to 1898 in a large automotive show that was happening in Boston. Some of the larger producers, relatively speaking, of course, of cars at that time were displaying. The day after the display, there was going to be a public demonstration of the cars at a local track. Having heard of the Stanley car, a writer for a Boston newspaper lobbied the event organizers to let them into the demonstration, even though it was just meant for the cars that had been displaying at the static show, and the Stanleys, of course, had not done that. As they likely saw no harm in allowing some local home-built steam car in contrast to the big money iron in the show, they let the boys in. After watching all the cars make their speed trials around the reserved racetrack, F.E. Stanley went out and the Stanley Steamer made three laps, covering 1 mile in a time of 2 minutes and 11 seconds. Doesn't sound like much, but frankly, at this time, that was a new world's record for covering a mile distance in an automobile. The previous record was 2 minutes and 32 seconds, set on a straightaway in France. Likely in shocked silence, the crowd turned their attention to the hill climb portion of the trial. The little Stanley, with its insanely torquey steam engine, lack of a transmission, and associated slipping clutch, dominated this section of the exposition as well, and within 2 weeks, the brothers had received 200 unsolicited orders for cars at their business that frankly didn't exist yet. This was an indication that their former hobby had all of a sudden turned into a business. Buying a former bicycle factory near their existing dry photo plate factory, they packed it full of people, machines, and materials, and the Stanley Motor Carriage Company was born. Now, just when it seemed like the fellows are on their way and on their path, something crazy happened. Approached by a couple of businessmen, they were ultimately offered $250,000 for their company. This was a company that had barely produced a single car so far. The brothers had effectively $20,000 tied up in the whole works, and so they took the deal. They sold the factory, they sold their patents, they sold everything. They weren't allowed to make their own steam cars for a period of about a year, and they were working for the new buyers who changed the name of the company to Locomobile. And while they weren't making their own cars, they still did have involvement with Locomobile. For instance, in 1899, Amzi Barber, one of the executives at Locomobile, encouraged an idea F.O. Stanley had. He wanted to be the first guy to drive a car up Mount Washington in New Hampshire. No one had ever done it before. With his wife Flora, he left eastern Massachusetts and drove to the mountain in a car built at the Stanley factory and branded a Locomobile, and then did what many thought was impossible. On August 31st of 1899, he and his wife drove the treacherous 8-mile mountain road in 2 hours and 10 minutes, making multiple stops for water and allowing horses by and who knows what else. It was another publicity bonanza for the company. Now, the Locomobile sale had a bizarre ending. By 1901, Locomobile had decided to ditch steam cars altogether and move all their manufacturing to the state of Connecticut, and this would leave the plant that the Stanley brothers had sold them abandoned. In May of 1901, the brothers bought all their stuff back, the factory and the patents included, for $20,000. Remember, they had sold it for $250,000. In 1902, they sold usage rights to their engine patent to the White Car Company for $15,000, meaning their total cost in recovering their company was $5,000 off of the top of $250,000, and that's incredible. Perhaps even better than that, these guys had been biding their time and by 1901 had a load of new ideas they wanted to employ on their new automobiles. When word got out that the Stanleys had their company back, what their improved designs were, and that they were being made, the company was flush with orders right off the bat. In the 1889 time frame, F.E. and F.O. Stanley hired a young man in his 20s named Fred Marriott, and little did any of them know that he'd be destined to create some of the most amazing headlines the Stanley Motor Carriage Company would have ever dreamed to own. He was a young mechanic who had apprenticed at the Petty Machine Works and then gone on to be a lead mechanic at the Union Cycle Company factory. Known as a phenom in solving complex mechanical issues in a jiffy, he quickly impressed at Stanley. Fred Marriott was also a racer of bicycles and had enough talent to be the town champion of Needham, Massachusetts, which, laugh at it now, but was really no small shakes in those days. Placed in the role of foreman in the factory repair department, Fred Marriott had hit the gearhead jackpot. That department, with the boring name, designed parts, fixed cars, did special projects, and as he'd soon learn, built race cars. There were plenty of places to go racing in 1902. Typically, they were horse tracks, but there were exceptions. But if there's one thing you could be assured of if you were racing in America at this time, you'd either be turning left on a circle or perhaps on some form of closed public road. But what if there was a third option? As it turns out, there was. Ormond Beach, Florida. Slowly but surely, the Ormond Beach area had started to become a bit of a resort destination after some New Englanders moved south and began operating hotels on Florida's eastern shore. After getting improved access to the area through better rail service, places like Hotel Ormond opened up. This is where a man named James Hathaway stayed in 1902. Not only did he stay there, he had shipped a Stanley steamer down to enjoy the area as well. Hathaway had raced his car around the Narragansett Park track in Cranston, Rhode Island, running against the mile standards of the day to see how fast he was. Once Hathaway laid eyes on the 30-plus miles of straightaway on Ormond Beach with its width of hundreds of feet, sand as hard as concrete, and occasionally strong tailwind, he knew exactly what he had to do. He measured out a mile, and then he ran his car down it. It ended up being 15 seconds faster than he had ever run at Rhode Island, and immediately he knew that this was as good a racetrack as nature could ever produce. Hathaway went on a wild letter-writing campaign to promote the area and get the attention of the automotive world, and one of the guys who got a letter and decided to investigate was a journalist named William Morgan of the Automobile Magazine. A former bicycle racer and well-known automotive writer, Morgan went down in 1903 and was immediately blown away by what he saw. Getting with the area hotels for promotion, he decided that the Automobile Magazine should try and have a race on the beach by the end of 1903. Now, this was a short time window, but they pulled it off. The hotels jumped on the idea, and while it didn't draw a massive crowd of cars for the first time, the right cars showed up. We're talking guys like Ransom E. Olds and Alexander Winton, just to name a couple of the luminaries. In fact, during the festivities in 1903, James Hathaway, who had started the ball rolling on all this stuff, set a new steam mile record in his Stanley at 1 minute 28 and 2 fifths of a second. The premier event, though, was held on the last day. This was a 1 mile standing start drag race. Of course, they didn't call it a drag race, but that's exactly what it was, between Alexander Winton and his Bullet and Horace Thomas driving the Ransom E. Olds' own machine known as the Pirate. This was a squeaker, with the Bullet winning by 1/5 of a second for a total time of 1 minute 15 to run a mile from a standing start. But how about that? A legitimate side-by-side, 1 mile-long standing start drag race in 1903. Now, something else happened in 1903 far north of Ormond Beach. The Stanleys built a race car. Some called it the Torpedo and some called it the Turtle, but it was sleek for its day, and it started to incorporate basic ideas that would be present in the Rocket in the coming years. That car was raced locally in the 1903 to 1904 timeframe. The body of the machine, which started out as kind of blunt nose, flat and wide, would be modified over time and look eerily similar to what the Rocket would end up looking like in 1906. On May 30th, 1903, the Stanley racer smashed the 1 mile steam world record to the tune of 1 minute, 2 and 4 fifths of a second, and this was done on a circle track in Massachusetts. The 1904 Ormond Beach races were setting themselves up to be pretty amazing. As it turns out, the Stanleys wouldn't be there. This was the time frame when the Eastman Kodak Company came to make an offer to buy their photoplate business, and as such, the brothers stayed home to finish that transaction rather than going to Florida. The good news for them is that they didn't miss out on the headlines. 15 cars came to Ormond in 1904. Among them, a Packard, a Stevens Duryea, a Locomobile, a 90-horsepower Mercedes, a Wild Christie front-wheel driver, a 70-horsepower Peerless, and the 120-horsepower Winton Bullet II, driven by Barney Oldfield. The craziest car? The Baker Electric Torpedo Kid. It was fully electric, and it was shaped like nothing anybody had ever seen. There was also a stock Stanley steamer, driven by a man named Lewis Ross from Massachusetts. By the end of the week in 1904, every major speed record had been reset, including the stock steam car mile record, which was set by Lewis Ross at 55 2/5 of a second to cover a mile. Well, the factory stock and street-driven Stanley was not a pound-for-pound match against the truly hairy-chested race cars of the day. It was more than capable of hanging with those guys and close enough to make the rich guy sweat. This alone caused many to give the steam cars a lot of respect. Now, outside of Ormond, steam cars have been dominating events like hill climbs from the late 1800s into the early 1900s, but by 1904, the gas cars with ever larger and more powerful engines had begun to catch up. At Mount Washington in 1903, a gas car finally broke the standing record set in 1899 by Stanley. But then a week later, a New Yorker named Austin Hoy took his Stanley up to the top of the mountain in 1 hour and 39 minutes to steal the record back from the gas cars by some 7 minutes. At the 1904 Commonwealth Ave hill climb in Boston, we see Fred Marriott entered as a Factory Works driver for the first time. The operator of the second entry from Stanley was Lewis Ross, who had been at Ormond in the winter months. Marriott won the steam class but came in third again overall, showing just how the gas cars had narrowed the performance gap between the steamers. At the 1904 Mount Washington hill climb, F.E. Stanley took the tiller and whizzed up the mountain in 28 minutes and 16 seconds, by far the fastest time in history. He even drove it up to the top of the railway platform at the summit in an apparent dare from photographers. Ultimately, though, the quickest time of the day would go to the 60-horsepower Mercedes driven by Harry Harkness, who managed a time of just over 24 minutes in an $18,000 car, which scared him so badly, he took the cog railway down from the top and made somebody else bring the car back to the bottom. Now, Stanley, as per the rules of the event, sold his car for list price, which was $650, to a spectator that wanted to buy it. Apparently, this was done as claimer rules are done in stock car racing in the modern world, as to not overinvest in your equipment, knowing that it could be sold for retail price. 1904, though, had a whole lot more in store for the Stanley boys. In fact, it would be a car which they didn't even build that would keep them in the international racing headlines during the early months of 1905. Lewis Ross, who had run his stock Stanley at Ormond in 1904, went all in for 1905. He had Frank Worcester of the Watch City Automobile Company in Waltham, Massachusetts, custom build a chassis of his own design. He consulted with F.E. Stanley for a boiler of 16 inches diameter, which could handle 800 psi of pressure, and a pair of 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch bore-and-stroke twin-cylinder Stanley steam engines for power. He built his own unique aerodynamic body out of sheets of aluminum, and the car was dubbed the Airship by some newspapers and the Tea Kettle by some others. It rode on semi-elliptical springs, and because it had two piston engines driving the rear tires, which were not 100% synced, it had the propensity to wobble about and move around as it was accelerating. And so the most commonly known name for this car is the Wobble Bug. Finished in mid-1904, the car was immediately set to the racetracks of New England, and after a couple of opening outings that went kind of rough, it was sorted out and started to work very well. The car set records with consistency throughout the back half of 1904, won races, and by the time it was sent to Ormond Beach, it was fully sorted out. Weighing 1,250 pounds with full water tanks, the only major alteration that was made was the addition of aluminum discs over the wire wheels for aerodynamic purposes. The car was shipped by train from Massachusetts to Florida with very high hopes. Interestingly, the media had begun to believe that this was actually a Stanley car because of the fact that their components were used and the apparent influence they had had on Ross. But once again, in 1905, the Stanley brothers decided to stay home rather than travel to Ormond Beach. However, their nephew, Newton Stanley, who worked in the photographic plate business with them, traveled to the event with tragic consequences. On January 21, 1905, while riding a motorcycle down the beach at the waterline, a 75-horsepower Smith & Mabley Simplex, driven by Frank Crocker, came rocketing down the sand in near the same position. Swerving to the left to avoid a breaking wave, that put him directly in the path of Crocker. Newton Stanley then caused a disaster. Crocker swerved to miss him, losing control of the car and crashing in horrific fashion. Crocker's riding mechanic, Alexander Raoul, was killed instantly. Crocker was transported from the scene, dying the next day in medical care. Stanley's leg was broken so badly it was partially amputated. Coker and Raoul were the first two people killed on Ormond Beach in an automobile. But as they so often did in the time, the events went on. In a sea of the world's most expensive and high-technology race cars, Lewis Ross's oddly shaped machine stood out. The lack of a banging internal combustion engine, the large stack out the back, and mostly enclosed driving positions were not the only startling looks. They raised eyebrows amongst those that knew race cars in the crowd, and this thing was nothing that they had ever seen before. Oh, it ran like it, too. Ross kicked off the week crushing the competition in the 5-mile race for cars valued at $651 to $1,100, winning by more than 1 minute. The most anticipated race of the week was the Sir Thomas Dewar Trophy Run. Dewar, the man who took his family's Scottish distillery to international fame, and it's a product that people still consume today, was a sportsman and a lover of all things mechanical and fast, and so he tied his name to the Ormond Beach races, creating this particular award, making this an international affair with some glory attached. The format was simple. It was a rolling start, 1-mile sprint. The driver in the inside position, the one closest to the ocean, controlled the speed of the roll at their discretion, and then at the starting line, it was full throttle for a mile. And amazingly, Lewis Ross had that inside position as well as a plan. Keeping his speed down so that the gas cars would have to stay in low gear, his direct drive steamer was primed for launch when they got to the starting line, and launch it did. He won the first heat with an elapsed time of 41 3/5 of a second. In the final round, he had to take on a big Napier car with about 100 horsepower, and he won again, this time by a single 1/5 of a second. It was stunning. A home-built freak had taken on and won over the world's best. In fact, over the course of the week, the little steamer dominated. Entering 8 different races over the course of the event, Ross recorded 7 first-place finishes, 1 second, set 2 Steam World records, 1 competition record, and frankly stole all the headlines. No one saw he or his little car coming. As you can imagine, the early 1900s, a speed-crazed America with plenty of people to throw money around, became obsessed with owning Ross's car. The highest bidder was a New Yorker named Charles Heineman. Heineman didn't drive the car himself, instead hiring Joe Nelson to drive it for him, and on May 6, 1905, Joe Nelson crashed the car at the Brighton, New York track, completely destroying it. The last the world ever saw of the Wobble Bug. Ross claimed to not want to pursue a career in racing, and that's why he sold the car, although we're going to question that shortly. Now, clearly Ross's performance, powered by Stanley Parts, inspired something in F.E. Stanley. Shortly after Ross got back and the headlines subsided, Stanley committed to building a racer that would not just duplicate Ross's performance, but blow his and every other race car in the world straight into the weeds. Ross may have started something, but F.E. Stanley was going to finish it. Before we get into the 1906 Stanley Rocket specifically, we have to understand how steam-powered cars work and why they were a great fit for this type of competition at Ormond Beach. As compared to traditional internal combustion cars, they're insanely simple, have prodigious amounts of a particular amount of force that even huge gas engines couldn't touch at that time, and that, of course, is called torque. A steam-powered car works in virtually the identical way as a steam-powered locomotive. There's a tank of water, there's a boiler, there's a burner, and there's a set of pistons that turn a crankshaft, which in turn moves the wheels. In the case of the Stanleys, they had developed their own boiler, and it was a scalable design which was very, very safe. In the case of Stanley's Rocket, they had developed a boiler that was 30 inches in diameter and 18 inches tall. The inside of the boiler was filled with 1,475 tubes in which water flowed. Combining the surface area of all these tubes, the boiler had 285 square feet of heating area. The boiler was usually run at about 1,000 psi of pressure, but could be pressed harder when needed. Now, if you're worried about explosions, let's stop there a second. This boiler couldn't explode in the way you're thinking. Yes, internal tubes could rupture, burners could crack, but the actual integrity of the boiler was protected with a tight and voluminous wrap of steel wire. Now, this was a technique used for the better part of 50 years on cannon, naval guns, and other applications. The tensile strength of the wire, especially when wrapped in volume, was amazingly strong, making the boiler itself virtually impossible to rupture. There are no recorded cases of a Stanley steamer ever blowing up a boiler that I could find. So, if we're making 1,000 psi of superheated steam, what happens next? That's the stuff that will be released from the boiler and piped to our pistons. Now, steam engines can't stall, and they make their peak torque at basically 1 RPM. You simply just keep feeding pressure into it until the pistons start to move, no matter what. In the case of the Stanley engines, they're also double-acting. This means that the steam is shot in the top of the bore, forcing the piston down, and then via slide valve, steam is then shot in the bottom of the piston to send the piston up, or in the case of these lay-down engines, back and forth. The pistons use rope-style piston rings to seal themselves inside the bore, rudimentary, yes, but also functional. Occasional issues with breaking cylinder heads and pistons were part of the racing program, and would be resultant in the amounts of high pressure that they were entering into the cylinders. With a 4.5-inch bore and a 6.5-inch stroke, the 1,000 psi of pressure being applied to the pistons was top and bottom both. F.E. Stanley figured that this combo would make 2 times the power Ross had with his far smaller displacement dual engines. Now, this car did not run a transmission of any sort. You may think that's impossible, but consider the fact that a steam locomotive capable of pulling millions of pounds didn't use a transmission either. In the case of the Stanley, speed was to be achieved by gearing, and to say that it is steep would be an understatement. The engine was geared 0.5 to 1 to the axle. This means that for every 1 revolution of the steam engine, 2 revolutions of the rear tires would occur. It's backwards math to most gearheads, and you have to think about it for a second to really understand it. For instance, in a regular car, a 411 gear and a hot rod means that the engine turns 4 times for every revolution of the rear tires. This is the complete opposite of that and makes us appreciate the prodigious torque output of the steam engines. In the Stanley rocket, the engine made 300 revolutions per mile, or 10.5 revolutions per second as far as the pistons went, and 21 revolutions per second as far as the tires went. So again, it is completely opposite. For every one revolution of the engine, you get 2 revolutions of the tires. In the car you drive down the street, the engine has to make multiple revolutions to get 1 revolution of the tires. And of course, not all steam cars carry this massive gear ratio, which was one of the reasons this one had such a high top-end speed. So, before we move along, the more efficient the boiler, the more scalding hot the burner, the more pressure that could be made, and the more pressure that could be applied when the throttle was open, full steam ahead, the faster the car would go. All that make sense? Okay. Next up is the most radical part of the whole program, which is, of course, the body and frame. It was a canoe. Literally. Stanley knew that Ross was on the right track with the shape of his car and its approach, but he knew he could do better. Canoeing was a national pastime at this moment in history, and canoes carved through the water easier than most other boats. There were plenty of people making them and plenty of designs to choose from, so how did he pick? Believe it or not, he did it with testing. F.E. Stanley built a rig where he could tow various designs of canoes behind his car, and with a spring gauge, he could measure how much effort it took to pull them along at speed. Now, perhaps this is the most early and certainly the most odd aerodynamic testing for a car in racing history, but it's still pretty amazing that he had this idea and used it. Was it at all accurate? Who really knows? Or, at this point, who really cares? I just think it's kind of awesome. Light, long, and streamlined, lacking in frontal area to push, it was a smart move to use the canoe shape, and the J.R. Robertson Canoe Company of Auburndale, Massachusetts, got the call to make a slightly modified version of their Riverside model canoe. Robertson not only made the canoe body, but also the top to fit. Now, there's some question if the Riverside was chosen because the boiler naturally fit, or if the design was altered to fit the boiler, but either way, we now know who and what in terms of the body, and who made it for the Stanley rocket. When the car was constructed, Stanley made sure to put everything in the body, including the leaf springs. So that means only the tires and the nose of the car and the little spindly axles are exposed, giving a frontal area of 9 square feet, which is an astonishing number, not only for then, but for now when we talk about speed cars. F.E. Stanley, Fred Marriott, and the other engineers at the factory completed the car in time for some light testing in 1905 before preparing to send it south for the 1906 Ormond Beach races. Stanley estimated the car was capable of 120 miles an hour. That was a speed no human had ever achieved in an automobile. The 1906 Ormond Beach races were comprised of a menagerie of 27 different events. Some were open to all. Some were restricted on price and the weight of cars, some by power plant. There were straight sprints, distance races with turns, and more. The Durer Cup, awarded for the 1 mile international championship, was still the peak draw event, and a new 2 miles per minute trophy would be awarded as part of a flying 2 mile contest, and that would go to the racer who went furthest over 120 miles per hour. There were races of 5, 10, and 30 mile distance, some starting from a standstill, some from a roll, and some from flying starts. There was also the greatest collection of high-powered cars the world had ever seen. 110-horsepower Christie's, a 200-horsepower Duroc, 100-horsepower Napier, a 90-horsepower Thomas, a 110-horsepower Mercedes, a 110-horsepower Fiat, and on and on and on. There were also 15 to 20-horsepower Stanleys, the 50-horsepower Rocket, and a 250-horsepower Vanderbilt Spooner, which, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for the other racers, did not compete. The driver lineup at this event was also legendary. Louis Chevrolet, Paul Sartori, Christie, Kulik, Lancia, and yes, Fred Marriott. A story unto itself, Louis Ross was supposedly going to be the driver of the Rocket before heading down to Florida. So much for not wanting a racing career, right? This was until he had a falling out of some sort with Stanley. Now, having raced for the company since 2004, Marriott was tapped to drive. Also, as the car was supposedly built specifically to his dimensions, one wonders if he was going to be the guy all along and Ross just got the memo late. Either way, Marriott was an absolute dominator. In the Durer Cup in the first heat, he set a new world record for the mile at 32 1/5 seconds, And in the second and final heat, he ran an even 32 seconds, another record, and destroyed the competition. In the one-mile steam competition, he lowered his own world record to 31 and 4/5 seconds and won again. In the five-mile race, heat one, he set a new record of 2 minutes 47 and 1/5 seconds and finished minutes ahead of the competition. During the final, though, a cracked burner saw him shutting the car off after 3 miles and using the residual steam in the boiler to finish the race. Unfortunately, that caused him to slow and he was passed. He still came in third, and his time was still a world record for steam-powered cars at that distance. Thankfully, by 6 p.m. that evening, the car was repaired for the next day. On January 26, 1906, Fred Marriott covered the flying kilometer in 18 and 2/5 of a second after a 2-mile run-up and became the first person in the world to travel over 120 miles per hour in a car. His speed was 121.6. The Kilo competition being an open race meant that anybody could enter, and they did, and he wiped the floor with the gas cars. For the flying mile, the same approach was taken. A 2-mile run-up, and then wide open across the starting line. The mile was covered in 28 and a fifth seconds for a speed of 127.66 miles per hour. Fred Marriott was the fastest man on wheels in the world, and it was an accomplishment considered verging on the impossible at this time in history. No one had an answer for the Stanley Steamer Rocket. During the 2-mile-a-minute race, the engine blew a cylinder head out, the car suffered some body damage, and went off for repairs. Weather pushed it back a couple of days, and then on his first attempt, Marriott went 1 minute and 3 seconds over the 2-mile distance, the car bouncing and skittering, seeming to almost hover the front tires at times. In fact, passing the 1-mile marker on his next attempt, the front of the car was off the ground, and people thought that it may actually blow over backward. Undaunted, Marriott stopped the clocks in 59 and 3/5 of a second, another 120-mile-an-hour run. Now, Marriott did not want to run again and said as much and claimed he'd only go back out if his number was lowered, and unfortunately for him, it was. The 200-horsepower Duroc did the job in 58 and 4/5 seconds, and then race officials hastily closed the event before Marriott was given his last chance. Apparently, they had won enough, and the race officials had something else to worry about with regard to the Rocket, and so giving them another accolade was not something they wanted to do. The beating the Rocket had laid down was so thorough, so complete, that the complaints started before the race was over. Cars that were specifically built to go racing and couldn't actually be driven anywhere at this time in history were called freaks. A movement to ban them from further competition had started. The organizers were faced with a classic racing promotional dilemma. The fastest car, the one that drew people from all over the nation to watch, was their biggest issue. The question is, what would they do about it for 1907? The answer, as it turns out, was nothing. But the racer sure did something. They used back channels to cause what was effectively a silent boycott of the event. The number of cars attending shrunk drastically. No European cars were entered in competition, and it was all tied to the Stanley and the fact that these guys all knew that they simply couldn't run with it. For their part, F.E. Stanley and Fred Marriott made some changes to the car to help the incredible vibration that would pass through it at speed. Now, there was one issue that was on the back burner and, although practically invisible, nagged at F.E. Stanley and Marriott. It was the car's propensity to get light in the front end at speed. They had done some rudimentary things on Ormond Beach to try to help keep the nose down, like adding sandbags and rocks to the front end of the car, but Marriott still said the front end felt like it was floating at times, and witnesses watched the speed in the 127-mile-an-hour run and saw the front end off the ground multiple times, but no real solution was ever encountered or deeply explored. It almost seems like F.E. Stanley didn't want to mess with a clearly good thing. All that said, though, having weight in the car, meaning all of the weight in the car, behind the driver, including the engine, the boiler, and everything else, was having some negative consequences on the high-speed manners and handling of the automobile. That much it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. The 1907 Ormond Beach event was a shadow of 1905 and 06. 5 Stanley cars were shipped down to various power levels, but the bad news was that the Rocket was beat up pretty badly in the shipping process. Its body was dented, dinged, and damaged in various areas, and it seems that the cars were rolling into each other in their train cars as they rumbled down the tracks. Adding to the already somewhat downer nature of the whole thing was a horrible-looking beach. A lack of rain had caused the sand to be choppy, rutted, and in some cases kind of troughed out. After days of waiting and running into the wind, Fred Marriott kicked off the week with a 38 3/5 second mile time, a long way off his 1906 pace. Ray Haroon, who would go on to fame as the winner of the first Indianapolis 500-mile race in 1911, was there with his beastly V8 race car. Unfortunately, that car spit a crankshaft out of it before it had a chance to race heads up. With no other capable cars in the category, the 1907 Dewar Trophy would be uncontested, and it would stay with Marriott from his 1906 performance. In the 5-mile Open Championship, the Flying Star race was a complete walkover for Fred Marriott. Finishing in 3 minutes, 44 and 4/5 seconds, the reporter from the Boston Globe described the car as bobbing like the clapper of a bell across the sand. Not great. In the 10-mile open race, disaster struck. The roughness of the course caused the rear of the body to break, allowing the engines to fall down and effectively expire. And this caused everything to break internally as well. Repairs were made hastily over the course of a day or so, repairing the body and reattaching it in some sort of a way, as well as stealing parts off of the other racing Stanleys, brought the car back onto the sand, where it ran at 31 seconds or 31 and 4/5 of a second over the course of a mile, showing that it was working, but still not as fast as it was the year previous. One thing that was pretty great was F.E. Stanley himself. He set the world record mile for steam passenger cars at 45 and 2/5 of a second, but the big numbers were still not coming from the team's big car. Finally, on 1/25 of 1907, after days of weather and conditional delay, it was announced that the final day for time trials on the flying mile had arrived, and for Fred Marriott, he knew it was now or never. With 1,300 PSI in the boiler, 200 PSI of fuel pressure, and 4 burners keeping it all lit and steaming, Marriott opened the throttle for the 2-mile run-up to the starting line. As he approached, the crowd stood in stunned silence. The rocket was surely traveling faster than anything they had seen before, and as it shot past the starting line about 200 yards into the time mile, it went into a dip in the sand, and as it came out, the front end caught the air and the car traveled about 100 yards on its rear tires only, floating like a leaf in the wind before it landed on rough sand, pitched sideways, and wrecked in such fashion that it was described as being, quote, smashed to atoms. The car was broken into a million pieces, and incredibly, while unconscious and bleeding, Marriott was still breathing. He was bleeding everywhere, had broken ribs, but he was intact. All the heavy parts had been torn out of the car's wooden body and frame. A spectator in a Rolls-Royce sped to the scene and transported Marriott to a clubhouse where doctors attended to him. Amazingly, by evening he was recounting the crash and showing no signs of serious head injury. It was astonishing that he was not killed. Marriott was quoted as saying at the time, quote, "It was as if the car seemed to take wings and fly up like a bird into the air," end quote. Glenn Curtis witnessed the whole situation and said the car's flat bottom acted like a wing, adding that the car seemed to glide with its rear wheels on the beach for an amazing amount of time. As Marriott was being taken off, so were the remains of his car. Souvenir hunters and spectators picked the remains of the rocket clean like a Thanksgiving turkey. It's estimated that Marriott was traveling somewhere in the neighborhood of 140 to 150 miles per hour when the calamity happened. If this is the case, he would have reset the land speed record of the world by an indescribably huge margin. But we'll never know for sure. One man who did make his mark unofficially that week in 1907 was Glenn Curtis. He rode his 40-horsepower V8 motorcycle to an unofficial, meaning stopwatch, not electrically timed, run of 136.3 miles per hour before a universal joint failed and the machine didn't run again. On February 22nd, Fred Marriott was back at the beach officiating a race. He was back to work at the Stanley plant by March 6th and back to racing locally and regionally at about the same time. Well, he never hit the sands of Ormond Beach again. He did race Stanley cars and other machines for years around the New England region. The Stanley Company never competed on the sands of Ormond Beach again either, as the rules were exclusionary to steam cars from 1907 on. It would take until 1910, during the final Ormond Beach race, for Fred Marriott's 127.66 mile per hour automobile land speed record to be broken. Barney Oldfield did it in the Lightning Benz with a speed of 131.72 miles per hour. It took 4 years for that one record to be broken, but incredibly, it would be 103 years for the steam-powered speed record to fall, finally being eclipsed in 2009 by a streamliner named Inspiration, driven by Charles Burnett to a speed of 139.8 miles per hour. Now that is debatably slower than Marriott was traveling before he crashed in 1906, and if you let that sink in for a minute, it makes this whole story that much more incredible. The Stanley Company would create and build steam cars into the 1920s, one of the longest-lasting and most successful manufacturers of that style of automobile. They produced about 650 cars a year and kept a business that made the brothers comfortable, certainly kept them entertained, and kept people driving in some of the nicest, most refined cars of the era. That's the story of the Stanley Steamer Rocket, a machine of incredible performance, incredible technology in its era, and one that took 103 years to be beaten at its own game. And if you didn't already know, now you do. I'm Brian Loans. Thanks for watching. Like and subscribe for more high-speed history, in-depth explorations, and downright unbelievable accomplishments. See you next time.